hairdresser and entrepreneur Michael Douglas joins me in this episode for a conversation that navigates risk, how to overcome obstacles, how to really forgive, and how to know when and how to apologize.
There's this saying called the weakness of your strengths, which is this very kind of weird paradoxical thing, which is you have these amazing strengths, but buried within them is all this weakness. I mean, I probably owe somebody an enormous apology, you know. And it probably isn't a day goes by where I don't think about that. But I can't think of a way of doing it that wouldn't make things worse. Truly, wholeheartedly believe the answer lies within you. Probably raising kids was probably the biggest challenge of all, you know, because you think that they're born a blank canvas and they're not. I think I lied quite a lot in the past. I lied to myself, I lied to other people, little lies, you know, just little things. And I thought, I'm not going to say what you want me to say because I don't agree with it. I don't get away with anything and neither does anybody else. So I think punishment is already out there taking place. So you should feel safe in the knowledge that if somebody's behaved appallingly, they will pay a price for it. I don't doubt that for a second.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My guest today is the hairdresser and entrepreneur Michael Douglas. He is a hugely respected name in the beauty world, famed for his accessible and informative hair advice, and now his range of hair tools, MD London. Michael shared his beauty problem solvers on an Instagram live with me recently, and his insights and tips on how to look after style and get the most out of hair have completely changed my approach to blow drying, the products I use, and crucially, the effect and looks I've been able to achieve. His advice was genuinely outstanding. And while we do talk about the usual suspects of risk and how to push your boundaries so you go beyond your comfort zone without freaking yourself out in this episode, we also stumbled across a few other topics, and Michael's words have really stayed with me since our recording. We talked about how to apologize and how to receive an apology, and we also talked about forgiveness and how to really forgive and not just say that you've forgiven someone. See if you can spot the moment when Michael talks about giving yourself a hard time. I haven't stopped thinking about that for weeks. And perhaps what's so pleasing about this conversation is that even though Michael and I have been in the same industry and have likely come into close proximity to each other many, many times over the years, we've only recently properly met, but I'm so glad we have. He is someone with whom you feel instantly comfortable. He's a great and thoughtful ear, and he is also an excellent guest in this episode. Well, welcome to the podcast, Michael Douglas. How are you?
I'm extremely well, thank you. Yes, I was drinking alcohol this weekend for the first time in a while. But it's now, what, Wednesday?
Yeah.
So I'm over it. I feel good today. I don't drink very much because, as you know, my partner doesn't drink. So there's never really much booze floating about, although I am I don't mind drinking. But I did it this weekend. And I was like, why does anybody do this? It's so horrible, isn't it? Ugh. But I feel better now. And I'm really glad that I'm not drinking again now for another sort of 2 or 3 weeks or something, you know.
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because I'm the same. I will have one drink, but I've had enough experience now of very, very bad hangovers in my 30s and now 40s to just go, it's just not worth it. I like feeling well.
And I went up north and they just casually drink up north, you know, like, should we have a pint and a bag of crisps? I'm like, what, 2 o'clock? Yeah, sure. I'm like, ugh. You know, like they just drink beer whenever, you know, it's so weird. Anyway. I feel great today.
Fantastic. I'm so glad. And so you You and I have known, this is really funny. So you and I have known of each other for probably, I would say, bang on 20 years. Like have operated in the same circles. But it was probably, we only really got to know each other very recently.
Yes.
Which I just find bizarre, but it's just the way it goes.
Well, I worked for Weller for a long time, which kind of kept me in a bubble, if you like, a Weller bubble. And unless you were, you know, I guess writing about those products, I wouldn't necessarily come into contact with you. You know, so I was isolated for many, many years. And then I became kind of independent, I guess, about, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. But I was still working for brands like Procter & Gamble and L'Oreal and stuff. So I was still slightly isolated, where I guess you worked with more independent hairdressers and stuff like that. But it is nice to finally get to know you.
I know. And so you are like one of the celebrity hairdressers. Like the name has just been elevated for years because you're so good at what you do. And actually we met because I came to your office, your studio, to pick up because we were doing an IG live together. And you'd very kindly got the products in. And I was in London and I was popped by and we had a lovely chat.
Yes.
I really enjoyed it. But furthermore, when we then did the beauty problem solvers and you shared the products that you absolutely rely on, I'm just going to tell you now, they are probably my three most recommended products. They're part of me. Your recommendations were amazing.
It's such a rewarding thing that, you know, I think the thing I like the most, when I post something on Instagram, I always think, why am I posting this? What's the motivation? Is it like a narcissistic thing? Am I desiring likes? But actually the thing I'm desiring most is for people to message me and say, I tried what you said. What a difference it's made. Thank you. I'm like, oh my God, that is the nicest thing. So just hear you say that is reward, you know.
Was that how you got into things originally? Because that must be an evolution on the journey.
Yes, it was. Lockdown was one of those weird things where, you know, everybody was isolated from work. I couldn't do anybody's hair, so I couldn't really earn any money, which is a bit tricky. And then, of course, I was bored, you know. And what I've witnessed on Instagram was lots of hairdressers who were obviously experts in hair, teaching people to bake cakes and stuff. You know, like everybody went like, they started doing pottery and stuff like that. I just think Pizza Express were teaching people how to make pizzas. Wagamama's were teaching people how to make their dishes. But hairdressers were teaching people how to bake cakes and stuff. I was just like, so weird. You know, why isn't hairdressers helping people with their hair? And of course, it was born out of fear because they thought, well, if people do their hair at home, they won't come to the hair salon. So everybody shut down, which was a kind of ludicrous way to think about things, you know. But I just thought, oh, do you know what? I don't own a hair salon. It's not a big deal for me. I'll go online and help people with their hair because that's my area of expertise. And the overwhelming love I got in return for doing that was unbelievable. A lot of hate from hairdressers. They really doubled down on me, you know, and I got an enormous amount of hate for that. But I realized in the end that everybody I helped largely messaged me and said, oh, you know, can we get an appointment with you when salons open again? I thought, I don't have a salon, you know. But what I realized is afterwards, I could have opened probably about 50 salons all over the country and filled them nonstop for about 6 months. Because once you help somebody, they want to pay you back, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So it's funny.
So it was an evolution of that, really. You said something, people liked it, and you thought, oh, this is so nice being able to help people.
Well, I opened the show and I asked people to tell me about their relationship with risk. And in regard to that, I would have thought that you wouldn't have thought there would have been any risk to your reputation or to your standing within the industry to offer advice on how to look after, trim, style your hair when hairdressing salons were unfortunately closed down for obvious reasons. But actually, that must have, you must look back and think, oh, that kind of bit me on the ass.
Yeah. So I did this thing where I went live on the One Show because I was a One Show face for about 12 years on that show, you know, once or twice a week. So it wasn't like I shouldn't have been there. I was there all the time. So I was one of their regular kind of reporters. They said, come on the show for 3 or 4 minutes and just tell people how they can look after their hair at home with the stuff from the supermarket. Now, I'd worked for Nice and Easy for about 20 years. So I knew all about home hair colorants and largely how good they were, actually. As long as you use them correctly, they work really well. And then various other things like how to trim a fringe or how to do a skin fade if you're cutting your kid's hair or something. And I tried to take the sting out of it by saying, look, it's not that difficult to do this. And we're all locked down for a bit. So it doesn't matter what you look like for the next few months. You can colour your hair at home, you can cut your kid's hair, and you can trim your own fringe. And actually, what I said was that the stuff that's in the boxes on the supermarket shelves is the same stuff that you get in the hair salon. It works in the same way, which is true. I thought, wow, I came off air live, you know. And what's interesting about that is you did it from your kitchen, a bit like this via Zoom, but to a black screen. You don't get to see the studio of the one show or anything like that. So it's just a black screen and you can hear Alex Jones and you can hear the other person, but you don't get to see anything, you know. So it was quite a weird thing, you know, you'd nothing to bounce off, you know. So I said this thing and then I went on Instagram, Twitter, and there was just a barrage of absolute hate and kind of reputation destruction and discrediting me and trying to ruin my reputation and all that stuff. And it was just nonstop. And then my kids started getting messages and basically hairdressers had just kind of doubled down and said, what this guy said, as in me, wasn't true and actually should not be trusted. He's no respect in the industry and he doesn't know what he's talking about and all the rest of it. It was just like, oh. And these were friends as well, people that I knew.
That's,
you know,
so rough.
So it didn't stop as well. It just kept coming. And it was one of those areas where you think, God, do I just apologize? And I got big into psychology and read a few psychology books and I was listening to people like Jordan Peterson and stuff like that on YouTube. And, you know, one of the things was, if you've not done anything wrong, don't apologize. You mustn't do that. And I remember thinking, oh, okay, so I do feel bad because and all these people can't all be wrong. Maybe I have done something wrong, you know, so I was really trying to work out what to do. So the following day, I put out a kind of statement where I said, look, I'm not going to apologize for saying the things I said because they are true. And the fact that hairdressers don't like that box dyes exist is not my fault. Like, I don't make box dyes, you know. But the truth is, Weller make hair color for salons and they also make hair color for the box dye. And those two things aren't massively different. They are pretty much the same. The fact that you don't like that, don't take it out on me, you know.
Mm.
So I did. I said my apology was about timing rather than the things I said was the time I said it, you know. And a lot of people took that on the chin. It was quite nice, but a lot of people didn't. And it just went on and on and on. So it was a proper feeling of cancellation. Two of my people that I worked with pulled out of me, you know, big clients decided they didn't want to work with me anymore. I have never been on the one show since. You know, they just stopped using me after that because they got 480 complaints. Ofcom got 320 complaints or something like that. Which is a big deal, you know, considering Jeremy Clarkson was the next person who was being complained about as much as me, you know. So it was terrifying, really. But I just decided to stand my ground with it, really, and thought, well, I didn't say anything wrong. I didn't lie. And I actually, I'm here to help people with their hair, not help hairdressers. Hairdressers, I've got this enormous support network within that industry. And I now saw myself outside of that industry and think, well, let's be the guy who helps people with their hair, you know? So in the midst of that, like, chaotic, terrifying moment, at the center of it became my purpose, which was a really weird thing to happen. And I've had several experiences like that since, where in the middle of the worst thing, you find the best thing, you know?
How interesting.
Yeah, you know, something paradoxical about life is what I've discovered over the last few years, is that in the middle of all the bad stuff is the good stuff, you know. And if you let it in entirely, out it comes, you know. I know that sounds a bit hippy-dippy, but there's something in it, you know. And I found that with raising kids as well, is that in the most terrifying thing of raising children, which is usually something centered around mental health problems or self-harm or something like that, is to walk into the scariest bit of it, and right in the center of that is the solution of it. So I learned an enormous amount about myself, about society, about life, about the whole cancel culture idea, and I became amazingly kind of more courageous and brave as a result of it, I think. And it was the best thing and worst thing that ever happened. That's weird.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to unpack there, because I think, first of all, I think that sometimes when you're having bad things happen to you, you simply cannot see, you can't flip it, you can't see it from another perspective, You get tunnel vision. So I'm curious if you sort of remember that moment where you were able to just move out of the eye of the storm and see it from a distance, and whether that was the moment.
It was. And I've thought about it quite a lot and had other experiences, like I said, over the last few years. And there's something about having the courage to surrender to it, whatever it is, you know. And it's a very weird thing, because surrender requires weakness and courage is about strength. And there's this saying called the strength, the weakness of your strengths, which is this very kind of weird paradoxical thing, which is you have these amazing strengths, but buried within them is all this weakness. They serve you well in one area, but are terrible for you in others. I've gone slightly off on a tangent, but there's something in the idea that you need to have the courage to stop. Mm. And I've realized that surrendering to the thing is what creates the vision for this rebirth or something like that. All sounds a bit psychedelic, but it's something about having the courage to surrender, you know, to it.
Well, I think with those situations, the reason I'm asking you about it so specifically is because I think when something like that happens, you can think about what if I'd done this differently? Why have people reacted like this? And you're sort of analyzing and spending your time on the thing that has already happened as opposed to the present moment and what you can do now.
Something very strange. A lot of people live in the future and they live in the past, you know. So you think about the past a lot and you think about the future a lot, but it's something in the moment. It's very hard to do that, which is why meditation and stuff like that's so important, is to try and like be present, be at one, you know, all that hippy-dippy language stuff. But there's something in it that's really crucial to finding the answer to your problem. And the other thing I found is the answer to all of your problems are buried inside you, you know. But then nobody else has got the answer to your problem. You have, you know. And I really, really learned that. Actually, you search deep enough, hard enough, far enough, with the right kind of mindset, it's all there, you know.
I 100% agree to you. And actually, I've just recorded a mini show about this, about how we have... In our culture, in the last, I would say, 10 years specifically, there has been a massive trend to elevate gurus. And these gurus are elevated on social media. Mm. Not necessarily because, and you can think about somebody topical that I'm thinking about at the moment, but we elevate them because they sound good, they look good, other people who we think are cool follow them. And so we suddenly put them into this incredible position of, they've got the answer. So if I just do what they do, my life will be the same. And you're really not doing yourself you're not helping yourself, because you need to be your own guru.
Totally agree. And I think you can draw on all these different people on Instagram and think, well, that's an interesting idea. I've never thought about that. You can apply it to your own life for a bit, see if it works. If it doesn't, it's not for you. You find something else. But yeah, I truly wholeheartedly believe the answer lies within you. It's not within somebody else. There's a great line in that Baz Luhrmann song, Wear Sunscreen, which is, I don't know if you know anything about that song. It was actually written by a woman. The words were written as an opinion piece for an article in the Chicago Tribune. So it's not written by a man, although it's voiced by a man.
Yeah.
And everybody thinks it's a speech from MIT, the class of 98 or something like that. And it's not that at all. All that's been made up. It's actually an opinion piece written by a woman. And when you read it, you realize it's the words of a woman, because it talks about beauty magazines and looking fat and things like that. And men wouldn't have ever really talked like that. Mm. There's a great bit in the final line, which is something about be careful whose advice you take. Advice is a form of nostalgia. It's the way of picking out the past from the waste disposal, wiping off the dirt and selling it for more than it's worth. And there's something about people offering you advice. It's like, no. I don't want it.
Yes.
The advice I need is like got to come from me and my own experiences, because it only relates to me, you know.
Were you always, was it recently, was it because of experiences like that you were able to find the answers within you? Where did you used to look for answers prior to that? Because I think we all go on this journey. Some of us figure it out sooner than later. But when did it happen for you?
Probably raising kids was probably the biggest challenge of all, you know, because you think that they're born a blank canvas, and they're not. They're born with already pre-built personalities inside them. So you're constantly having to kind of work out how to make that personality do what you want it to do. And ultimately what you realize is that, no, you need the personality to do what it wants to do, but in a safe way, you know. So there was something about letting go of your children from quite an early age and allowing them to broaden out within the confines of safety and everything, you know. So I think I probably learned it through raising kids. I think was to try and let go, realize that they're not my kids, they're their kids. And as they get older, you have to remove yourself more and more from their lives, which is the scariest thing you could ever do, but also the most rewarding thing you could ever do. Because once they realize that they achieve something all on their own merit, like, you know, your heart explodes with joy. You realize that it's their joy that you're in love with, you know, and it's nothing to do with me. You know, I haven't helped them do that. They did it, you know. So as they get older, you know, I just, there's more and more in that that I think that I realized that was about letting.
How old are the kids now?
20 and 18 in the next month. And we've just been, I was up north with them for the weekend. We do a trip to the Lake District every weekend where we go kind of mountain biking, zip lining, wake surfing, and just do lots of kind of adventurous, crazy stuff, you know. And it's just a great way to, again, let go a bit of your fear and try and do something mad, you know. So we've just done, the three of us have just done that this weekend. And God, it's just the happiest thing I could ever do. You know, it's just a joy, you know. We get on so well, the three of us. And I think one of the reasons we do that is because I let go of them to a certain extent, you know.
Are you at that phase now, given their age? I was chatting to a friend last night at a dinner who has children exactly the same age, 20 and 18, and is sort of was a little bit delicate about empty nest syndrome and was just sort of feeling like it's really, it feels like a massive change in my life. But then I also feel like I'm still young. And it's almost like I'm getting a second phase at life, except I know way more than I did. I've got more money than I had last time I had this kind of freedom, if you like. Are you going through that?
Yes. I had this theory, and I talked about this. I've got two really good friends who just had babies. It's so weird, like, to be 50 and then having friends that are having babies, but it's quite a few of them going on. My theory is that the reason it's so hard to raise kids, or one of the reasons it's so hard, is that you're endlessly grieving what they were and having to get used to what they are now. So they kind of almost die being a baby and then they're reborn as a toddler. And you have to slightly grieve that they're no longer a baby and never will be ever again, you know. Then they become a toddler, you've got to get used to that. And then they die being a toddler and then they're reborn as a child. And you've got to grieve the idea that you'll never be a toddler. You know, so there's this endless thing. So I am absolutely in a state of grief at the moment that they are gone, you know, and I'm having to get used to this new relationship. But there's so much joy in the new relationship that it somehow kind of mitigates the grief, you know. But there are days where I absolutely, you know, if Apple do that thing where they got Apple memories on your iPad and they throw up a picture from 4 years ago and it's like, oh, like, I would do anything to go back, you know, but I'd also do anything to go forward. It's something mad about the whole thing. So yeah, you're in a permanent state of grief and excitement. Like Jesus. So, but yeah, empty nesting. So my eldest son's just about to move out and move in with his partner. And that's so weird that his bedroom will no longer be his bedroom, you know, just getting my head around that's mad. But it's all part of the rich tapestry of life, isn't it? I always think, look, when I die, all I want to know is, did I have a good go at life, you know? And feeling upset and feeling afraid is just all part of that. I want to know that happiness wasn't the only important feeling, that fear and anger and feeling afraid and all that are equally as important as being happy, you know? I want to make sure I get them all, you know?
It's funny, this week has been a really sad week in the beauty industry because we lost somebody, a lovely friend of mine, Yuchenna. And it's been this really weird, I don't know if you've had a similar situation where you just sort of think, right, I've got to focus on the important things, which is spending time with my friends. And you suddenly, in your head, you think about how life will look if you weren't shackled by all the stuff that weighs you down. And then half an hour later, you think, but I do have to keep a roof over my head. So I have to be involved in all of those stresses and all of those worries, because life just isn't rainbows, parties, and high kicking all the time. And I've sort of gone, I've been dabbling with that this week. Help me with that. Like, how do you find that balance?
It's funny because obviously my partner is a desirable person. So we got an enormous amount of invitations to see people and lots of dinners and events and all sorts of stuff. And we've often said we have to stop saying yes to all these things because we are shattered. And we have to only say yes to the things we really want to do and the people we really want to spend time with. And we often get double bookings, you know, so we'll get one set of friends saying, will you come to this? And one set of friends that say, will you come to that, you know, on the same night. And we will sit on the edge of the bed or in a chair and we'll say, okay, let's ask ourselves privately, you know, what should we do tonight? Who do we go and see? And then we both shut our eyes and then open them and then say, and we always say the same thing. It's mad. Because the answer of what to do is, or you already know what to do. And the problem is that, you know, you're the naughty side of you or whatever talks you out of it. But yeah, the first answer is always the answer. And it was like, shoot, I'm going to change the names for obvious reasons, but let's say it was Jason and Sienna, you know, and we'll say, do we go to Jason's or do we go to Sienna's? And then shut our eyes and then we both open and go Peter's or somebody else or Jason's or whatever, you know, like, and we instantly know, you know what to do. So the worst thing you can do at that point then is go, yeah, but what about Sienna? It's like, no, the answer's been made. Like,
yeah,
you do that, you know. So, and we've also said, look, we've got to just start spending time with people that we really, really love and want to spend time with. And we're going to have to just kind of sacrifice a lot for other people, because otherwise you just do yourself harm, don't you? Do yourself an injury. And you know when you should stay in and not go out. And you know when you should go to work. And you know the jobs you should say yes to. And you say, I've been offered a really big job in November. A lot of money. And I do not want to do it.
Oh.
And on paper, I should definitely do it. But when I sit down and say, should I do this job? My whole being and my whole conscience is saying, you know you don't want to do this job. Don't do it.
Is it your whole being and your whole conscience, or is it 30 years of experience that's just saying?
Well, I think it's the same thing, because, right, you know, your conscience knows a lot more than you do, you know.
Yeah.
So it's saying, don't do it. You know, you don't want to do it. It's going to be a bloody nightmare. Or, you know, the money's neither here nor there. You don't really need the money. You've got your own business to concentrate on. Like, give it up. But for 30 years, I've been saying yes to those jobs. So it's hard to say no. But I think when you know, if you listen to yourself properly, you know, the answer comes, you know. So I try and respect that process, you know, and it seems to work. It keeps me a lot happier, that's for sure, you know.
You say about, well, you know when you need to stay in. I was just thinking there, just to be very, very honest with you, when I'm struggling, there will be little signs, and one of them is that I stop going out and I don't realize that I'm stopping going out.
Okay.
But I will be like, I have to go to this thing, and then I will cancel, and I will have a great reason, because, oh, I should really do some research. But actually it's because there's almost like, it's not agoraphobia, but it almost is like it shows up as a whisper of it. If I just get a little bit apprehensive about going out, and it sounds so daft, but there are days sometimes where I've like, oh, I need an office day. And then I get halfway through the day and I think you're hiding from something, like you're not 100%. And and so what I will do is I will make myself go out and go to something like the cinema.
Yeah.
Or go and run some errands, or go for a drive to break the, because it's almost cycle, like I can't control it. And so it's like, yeah, stay inside. Let's hide. Yeah. Let's hide you from the world.
Yes, it is interesting that, because you can lie to yourself quite quickly about what you're up to. And you also start to tell little lies to other people. Say, well, I can't come out tonight. I've got to do a bit of research. And actually, you don't have to do a bit of research. you're just saying, I don't want to go out tonight. So I over the last 5 or 6 years, I've tried very hard to never lie at all. So if I don't want to go out, I say to the person, I know you'd love me to come out tonight, but I just don't want to come out tonight. Just say that. And there's something about telling the truth that is so good. And you let go of, obviously, you have to let go of other people's feelings to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But if you never lie, you don't have to remember what you've said ever. You don't have to think about, what did I say to this person? Or anything. And your conscience becomes so clear and then so accurate in its ability to help you.
Yeah.
So if I don't want to go out and I don't want to explain why I don't want to go out, I just say, hey, it would be great tonight, but I'm just not up for it. I'm not going to come out. Have a great night. I'll see you next time. No lies.
That's so funny because you're reminding me about a time a few years ago where I was really like screwing up my diary. And I was, again, it was the thing. For me, it was showing up as I was struggling to go out. And I had sort of let a friend down timing wise. And she said, oh, no, Emma, the thing that I'm cross about isn't about the fact that you didn't I'm cross that you fibbed. And it was the fact that she used the word fibbed.
I know. It's slightly trivialized.
Me.
It makes it worse all at the same time, doesn't it?
So that's really interesting. So this, making the decision not to lie, just be 100% honest
yes.
at all times.
But, you know, within reason, you know, but certainly my theory was, I think I lied quite a lot in the past. I lied to myself, I lied to other people, little lies, you know, just little things. But I think what happens is your conscience starts to become corrupted in some way and it doesn't guide you particularly well. But if you tell the truth all the time, your conscience has a very accurate picture or map of you. And I think it guides you much more clearly. I think since I decided to really try and practice that for 5 years or so, I have never felt more free, more liberated, more happy. And I remember someone the other day said, I was on a flight recently and this woman, and she said, it wasn't me that was on the flight, actually. It was somebody else, but they told me this story. And I said, can I just stop you? Like, I am so proud that you did that. And she said, really? And I said, yes, because you're trying to pass the story off as yours and you slightly knew it wasn't your story. And then you readjusted yourself. And that is the thing. It's that kind of lie that trips you up. It's like, it's not your story. And you don't have to pretend it's your story. Just say, someone told me this story. And it's like, oh, you know, just some weight goes boom off you, you know, and it's just brilliant. So I've tried really hard that when people ask me a question, I try and be as precise and accurate about the answer as possible. And if I don't know the answer, whatever it is, it could be to do with hair or to do with what I did last week or whatever, I just say, I honestly don't know, or I can't remember, you know. But wow, has that made a massive impact on my mental health and my ability to feel happy, free, and all of that stuff, you know.
I'm bursting with excitement because I want to say that actually I know that for years and years and years, especially in my younger years in my career, and I regret this, I never wanted to be wrong. And so I would argue that black was white because I didn't want to show that I got something wrong. And it, obviously that makes you a bit of a prick in the workplace. Basically, like you a few years ago, I just thought, if I don't know, I'm going to say I don't know. And if someone comes on this podcast and they say something and they assume that I will know, but I don't know, I'm not going to do what I did in the past and nod, because that way I never learn. So I say, not only, and I do it and I'm like, for anyone who's listening who might not understand that, or I'll say, actually, I don't know what that is. It's so brilliant to just be able to go, I don't know. And if someone says, that, you know that, you idiot, you just think, well, who's the idiot now?
Yeah, there was something I read somewhere that said in an argument, if you win, you lose. And I love that idea that winning an argument is not necessarily a good thing to do. Having a discussion where you both kind of get something out of it, even if you disagree at the end, is just fantastic.
Like
every discussion you have, you should learn something, shouldn't you? You should take a little nugget away with you, but I didn't really know that. Or I'll research that when I get home and see what I think, you know. But I never, this whole idea that if you win an argument, somehow you lose something. You lose something in yourself, or nobody seems to learn anything. You know, just think, don't need to win.
That's very true. And if you look on social media, I know everything comes back to social media, but if you look at the way that we debate now, it really is about one-upmanship as opposed to healthy debate, sharing ideas, which is very interesting. I do want to go back to the terrible thing that happened to you when you got cancelled, because there were two more things that I want to unpick from there. One of them is about apologies, because I thought it was really interesting what you said about, I wasn't going to apologize because I wasn't sorry for what I said, but I wanted to acknowledge, acknowledge that what I said might have caused a reaction in people. And it was that reaction that you were sorry for.
Yes. And I went back and said, look, I perhaps, because I only had 3.5 minutes on TV, you didn't get to say, oh, let's not forget about hairdressers. You know, they're important and they're suffering. I just didn't have time to say any of that. Yeah. Perhaps I was, So I think the apology was about a timing issue and the fact that I hadn't caveated it with anything and I hadn't given a full explanation of anything. So I was sorry that I'd said this quite insensitive thing at a very insensitive time. But I was clear to say that I'm not apologising for what these companies are doing, where they're making products at both ends of the market. You know, that's just something that's happening. And it's not a big deal. You know, like, not everyone can go and get their hair coloured at a salon. They can't afford it. They haven't got the time. And they're not that bothered, you know, like. So I wasn't going to get into, what I didn't want to do, which I was being forced to do, was to be a mouthpiece for other people's idea. And I thought, I'm not going to say what you want me to say because I don't agree with it, you know. So that was it. What they wanted me to say is, actually, box dyes are terrible for your hair. Please don't use them. Wait till the hairdressers get open. And I thought, no. What I want to say is, box dyes are fine to use. Read the instructions. If you need some help, ask the company or ask me, and I'll do my best to help you. Or ask your hairdresser and say, could I use this and could I use that? They're safe to use. A number six is a number six, whether you're putting your hair in the salon or using, you know, Garnier or something like that. It's no big deal, you know, like blah blah blah. So yeah, I wanted to acknowledge people's that they were upset and they were stressed about their businesses, but I wasn't going to apologize just because they wanted me to. It was, and I was scared to death about that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And I've archived the post I did, actually. You could come, maybe I won't archive it so people can go back and have a look at it. I think it was about the 20th of March, 2019, maybe, was it, when we shut down? Well, 2020.
Yeah. 2020. That was like the day, I think, as it happened. Yeah.
And then it would have been the 21st. I put that. And then one of my clients asked me to remove it. And I said, no. When I say my clients, you know, a big brand had said, you remove what you've said. And I said, no. Because I thought, I'm not a mouthpiece for you either. You know, it's my bloody career on the line. And, you know, I'll take full responsibility of what I say and what I do, you know, but I'm being kind of shoehorned around by everybody else, you know. That was brilliant. It was a bloody brilliant. When I look back at it, you know, it's why I'm here, you know.
Yeah. It makes me want to ask you about apologies, though, because I think they are very interesting and a little bit like saying, I don't know, or I was wrong, which we'll come on to later. I think apologies are really hard to give and also to receive. And I wondered... And also, I've been apologised to in the past and it made the situation worse.
Yeah. Well, you're giving... somebody's getting off the hook, aren't they, you know?
That's exactly it.
Doesn't make it right because you said sorry.
Yeah. Is there a good way to give an apology, to apologise, or is there a good way to receive an apology?
We'll be right back after this short break.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Yeah. Is there a good way to give an apology, to apologize, or is there a good way to receive an apology?
I mean, I probably owe somebody an enormous apology, you know. And I probably isn't a day goes by where I don't think about that. But I can't think of a way of doing it that wouldn't make things worse. So I've yet to do it. But I think there will become an appropriate time where it will be sufficient and it will be, you know, the right thing to do. But it just isn't yet. I think one of the things that we have a problem with at the moment, you know, in society, is the overwhelming impatience that people have to resolve things. And I've found some of the greatest resolutions took a long time to sort themselves out. And they required the ability to do nothing in order to resolve it. So I think people want a quick resolve on it, you know, and actually there is no quick resolve. It requires a lot of time, a lot of thinking, a bit of distance, bit of perspective, and then maybe it might take 2 years, might take 10 years or whatever, and then the resolution comes. But I can't remember, there was something else I'd read that was this idea that the idea that you are the person that will make things better is extremely slim, and the idea that you are the person that makes things worse is highly probable. So sometimes the best thing you can do is to find the strength to do nothing and just play out. So, yeah, I think the apology comes. The reason apologies don't work is they're too soon and too fast, and they require a lot more time, you know, for things to resolve.
Yeah, and I think sometimes the apology I'm referring to, it was somebody who wanted it to evaporate, who wanted what had happened to evaporate.
Oh, wait, yeah.
And that wasn't going to happen. And so actually it just irked me a bit more. It was like, well, it has been years. I have made peace with what happened. But now
how long ago was this?
So it was 8.5 years between incident and apology. And I was like, I'm like, thank you so much. And obviously I accepted it publicly or to them, but privately I thought, actually, that's really churned it all up again for me, because it didn't resolve it for me. They got their closure, but I didn't.
But you, there's something about that. You have to own that, don't you? Yeah. You know, that is yours.
Yeah.
And it's hard because you want somebody to remove it.
Mm.
Yeah, it takes quite a bit of work, that, doesn't it? You know,
I'm not going to make you feel better about what you did.
Yeah, yeah.
I could only work on how I feel about all of it.
Yeah, yes. there's a saying, I think it's in NA or AA, which is your feelings are none of my business. Mm. And I found that quite helpful when I have feelings towards somebody else that are perhaps a bit angry or whatever, is that I think they are mine and they're none of their business. And I have to do something about that, you know. But yeah, it's bloody hard, I think. Relationships are tricky. The most complicated thing in the world is a human being. And then when you stick two together, there's nothing more complicated than that, you know.
So, it is like a science experiment, isn't it? You just even have to go to a party and just take a few steps back and you look at people like bouncing off each other like electrons, and you're like, you see some really positive energy, you see some quite negative energy. It's just, you're absolutely right. So complicated.
So complicated. And the fact that you don't even understand yourself particularly well, yet you make loads of judgments on understanding other people. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So the final thing I wanted to unpick about that story before we move on is about forgiveness, because you did have people say things publicly. And as soon as you said that, I was like, I think I saw a post on Facebook. So people were not shy, people who you knew, people in the industry who I'm guessing that you had friendships with, but also had professional respect for, said things publicly about you that were not favorable. How did you make peace with that? Have you forgiven them?
Yes, I think I felt forgiven at some point by them. I went to a couple of industry events and a lot of people came to say hello. There was quite a few people scathing at me, you know, but I didn't really care about that much. But look, there was quite a few people that came up and said, wow, that was risky what you went through, wasn't it? And I'd be like, yeah, but, you know, it's all fine. And then the whole thing seemed to blow away. And I think a lot of people recognised that they went slightly mad through that period, and then they felt a bit ashamed about the way they behaved, thought about perhaps what that might have been like for them. So there was a level of forgiveness there. And I think it was going back to what I said earlier, there was enough time had passed, I think, for people to perhaps reflect a little bit on what that was like. They didn't lose their business. Certainly didn't lose it as a result of a box die, you know. And I think there was something about the reality kind of set in, is that if you own a hair salon and you specialise in colour and you think your competition is a box dye on the Sainsbury's shelf, you are not very good at your job, you know. And I think there was a sense of that popped into it. But there was one particular hairdresser who really tried to take me out in a really quite a bad way. And he was quite famous and he had a big platform, much bigger than mine at the time. I only had about 5,000 followers. He had about 40,000. Which, you know, relatively wise, was a much bigger difference. And he got everybody to pile on top of me. And very weirdly now, although we've never actually met, we've had a very lovely relationship formed over Instagram. And we've both got brands in the consumer world, ironically. And we are working together very closely and helping each other. And it's just something very sweet about that there's absolutely no resentment from me, nothing from them. And we are now supporting each other in this funny journey, even though we've never actually spoken to each other publicly since then. We're helping each other on Instagram and reposting things of each other and everything. And I think, well, it's great. You know, like, I bear no grudges to anybody. You know, like, this is a very, very lovely, lovely thing that seems to have been born out of it. So the forgiveness bit is easy for me. Like, I don't think there's anybody I haven't forgiven, you know. Is there anybody I haven't forgiven? No, like I just don't hold on to any of it, you know.
I'm going to ask you, because I'm sure like there's a small part of me, and I'm sure there's listeners thinking, you who are going to be thinking a phrase that you used earlier, which is, but aren't you just letting people off the hook? And I think that's where I've always really struggled with forgiveness. It's like, if I do that thing where I release my anger because it's only harming me, it's not harming you, I'm like, I really want to be that person. I really want to get there. But I don't want to let you off the hook because you've screwed me, you bastard. So yeah. I'm not as evolved as I would like to say.
Well, one of the things that I'm familiar with is the idea that nobody ever gets away with anything. That's my thing. Nobody.
Go on.
I think they either beat themselves up over it or it comes back to get them. And, you know, the very famous narcissistic character that's being taken apart at the moment in the media is a good example of that, because he did behave appallingly in the past. And, you know, I've been in many dressing rooms with him and all sorts of stuff. And I could not stand the guy ever. And I thought, Christ, I hope one day this comes back to bite you on the arse, you know. And I've no doubt he's tortured himself over the years, and he's been living in fear for a very long time. And now it's all coming out to bite him. So that's one example of it. But I don't get away with anything, and neither does anybody else. So I think punishment is already out there taking place. So you should feel safe in the knowledge that if somebody's behaved appallingly, they will pay a price for it. I don't doubt that for a second. And there's lots of fantastic novels and books and all sorts of, whether they're fiction or whether they're fact, where that is absolutely crystal clear and plain to see. Nobody gets away with anything. That's what I think. So although you might not feel that there's sufficient payback it is going on. You should feel reassured that it's going on.
It's funny. I sent a message to a friend last week saying, as I saw a picture of an ex-boyfriend, and I was like, I want retribution. I want retribution. And there's a much bigger story that I won't go into. And she wrote back, she's like, babe, you're living your retribution. And I was like, okay, I changed my answer. I want penance. I want him in tears. I want him begging.
Wow. And
she was like, yeah, you need to evolve.
There's a thing on Netflix called Stutz. I don't know if you've seen that or not, but it's Stutz, S-T-U-Z. And okay. He's a psychoanalyst, you know, he's a therapist.
This is the Jonah Hill film.
It's the Jonah Hill thing, yeah. Now, I'd highly recommend you watch this. We've recommended this on our podcast a few times to people because I think there is stuff in there. He's in his 80s, I would say, Stutz, and he's been a therapist for a very long time, a psychoanalyst, fully qualified, you know, really good and had an enormous amount of experience. And obviously he's treated Jonah Hill. You can think what you like about Jonah Hill, but it's not about him. It's about this guy's philosophy and ideas around how to help people with their crisis, whatever it is. And he's got a great one on in there about forgiveness and about letting go of perhaps somebody who's betrayed you badly, somebody you really dislike, somebody you really want bad things to happen to. He talks about a technique in there. And I really loved it, and I've practiced it with people I need to let go of, you know, and I found it very, very helpful. But one of the things he talks about there really is that when people come to a therapist, and I went into therapy briefly for a while, and I didn't find it massively helpful for me, but he said, you know, what most therapists do is they listen to you until you resolve your problems. And I think that's the thing. But actually, you can do that with a good friend or something like that. You don't need to pay for that. But he said, it's not good enough that. He said, you need to leave this office with help, with something helpful. So he said, that's what I do. You walk out this office with some little cards that I've drawn some pictures on and some ideas and stuff like that. And he says, if you do the things I tell you to do, you will feel 70 to 80% better almost straight away. And I was like, fuck, that's so good, isn't it? You know, like, that's what people want. They just want to feel a bit better. And he has things in there that he says, do this, do this, do this, you'll feel better. And I think he's absolutely right about those things. There's nothing revolutionary about them. But the one about letting go of somebody who's wronged you, I thought was really good. And you can't just do it once and it all worked. You have to do it a lot. But it's about love and all sorts of things. But it's really good. And it's a really interesting exercise that you think, fuck, can I do that and think that about this person who's wronged me so badly, you know? And you think, yeah, we'll do it and see what happens, you know?
I do that thing. Not that this is a particularly current problem. It's just when I was thinking about these particular topics. But I've done that thing where I've thought about those people and I've thought, I wish you nothing but good. And try to do that. And I do try to flip my brain so that if they pop into my head or whatever, I'm like, I wish you well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our story is over. I wish you well. It's tough, man. It's tough.
It is. It really, right. Really is. Yeah.
I'm going to watch this after this. So let's switch gears a little bit because I'm curious about, I've already learned so much, but I'm now thinking, so you've been this incredible celebrity hairstylist for years who's working with these huge brands like Weller, been on the circuit, traveling around the world, working with all of these huge, huge names. And then you're like, I know I'm going to seek investment and I'm going to start my own business and I'm just going to make my life a little bit harder to potentially make it massively better.
Yeah.
Was that the thought process?
Yes, it was. I think when I left the world of professional hairdressing, worked in consumer products, I went to work for Procter & Gamble, I worked for L'Oreal and Coty and stuff like that. I had a vision that we're going back to when I was like 27, 28, but I thought I'll become famous, I'll become really good at my job, I'll launch a business. Yeah, I live happily ever after. That was kind of the plan, you know. So I got myself a TV show, the first thing I did. So I met a TV producer and I said, look, I want to be like the Jamie Oliver of hair. Put me on TV. I'll do this whole thing, you know. Thought that would be easy, but it was a bloody hard work. But I thought the first thing was to become very well known, you know. Nicky Clark had done Anthea Turner's hair. I'm not sure how old you are, but I don't even remember how famous Anthea Turner was in the 90s. But she was the biggest paid female TV presenter ever in the history of British TV. She was massive and everybody wanted her hair. And Nicky Clark was her hairdresser.
Until Snowflake.
until the Cadbury snowflake incident. Yeah, I mean, that was probably one of the first cancellations of our generation.
Ever. It's huge. If you don't know what that is, when Anthea Turner's wedding was covered by OK magazine, they were sponsored by Flake, and they had Snowflake, which is a white chocolate flake. God, now my mouth is watering. It's literally just
saliva.
And it was seen as being, I mean, when you judge it next to what goes on today, it's laughable that it had the reaction that it did, but it was seen as just the most distasteful thing that had ever happened. And I mean, her career was impacted, but yeah, sorry, her hair.
Yeah. So Nicky Clark had done her hair, and he was the most famous hairdresser in the world, arguably. And he had the most famous client. So one of my other things was get a famous client with desirable hair. And then you're the guy who did it. So I had a plan, you know. And very weirdly, I bumped into Davina around that time, and we shot a hair commercial, and she asked me to be a hairdresser, and her hair became amazingly desirable, you know. So it was quite weird that things had fallen into place. And just so you know, like I used to meditate on this stuff. I used to ask the universe for this kind of stuff, do a bit of meditation, and then weirdly it would kind of land on me. Now, that could be a coincidence, by the way, so I'm not a great believer.
Well, this is like early stages manifestation before manifestation was a thing.
Yes. And me and her talk about this a lot. She's a manifester as well. She wants something. She asks the world for it. She goes on podcasts, asks the podcast for it. Poof, you know, it happens. Hence the reason her TV show at the moment, My Mum, Your Dad, came as a manifestation on the Diary of a CEO podcast, you know. So we both do this quite a lot. But I'd asked for a celebrity client. I'd asked for a TV show, which I got. And, you know, I asked for a kind of enough money to keep me bouncing along. So I got all these things. The TV show was really good. It was called the original one was called The Hair Man, and then one was called The Stylistic. And it was on the Discovery Health Channel, which was okay. You know, it was a pretty good TV show. I then owned the production company that made it, so I was a TV producer as well. You know, so I was having a great old time. But I just couldn't crack the getting a brand together. And there was two or three reasons for that. One is that I would go to Boots and Superdrug and say, you know, I'm on TV, I've got famous clients, I want to launch a range of shampoos and stuff like that. And they'd say, okay, who is Michael Douglas? And what problem is he solving for women? You know, and I would go like, yeah, who is Michael Douglas? Like, I'm the cheeky chappy from the north, you know, and I will make your hair look great. And he's like, yeah, but we've got Lee Stafford, you know, he's the cheeky chappy from Essex and he makes people's hair look great. I'm like, okay, I'm the salon at home. You know, you get salon quality hair at home. It's like, Charles Worthington does that. I'm like, okay. And it's like, well, I'm Mr. Frizz. You know, I'll get rid of Frizz. It's like,
oh,
John Frizz.
Sorry, John Frizz. I'm like, got that face.
And then I was like, yes, who am I? You know, so I just let go of the whole thing because I thought, until I can launch a genuine solution to a problem, largely for women, but you know, it could be for guys as well. But I thought, there's no point in doing this. There's no point putting soap in a bottle and selling it to people. Everybody does that, you know. So I just sat on the back burner for years, tried to get a kind of decent TV career off the ground. You know, my dream was to make a hair program that a bald man would find entertaining. You know, it had to transcend hair, basically. So if you think about Top Gear, you don't have to like cars to enjoy Top Gear. Just these three blokes sticking about. And I thought, we need to make a program about that. Nobody wants to make a program about hair. No broadcaster wants to do that, you know. I remember when Jamie Oliver left BBC Two, we went to pitch there. And we had this great showreel and everything. We sat in this room and they said, okay, we really like you, Michael. And we think you'd be great on BBC Two. What can you cook? I was like, what? You're going to cook something, right? I was like, no, I'm going to do people's hair. And they were like, oh, no, nobody wants to see that. And then I was like, well, I don't cook. And they were like, can you garden? Could you be a gardener? I was like, no, it's good. You know, it's like, oh, nobody wants hair on TV, you know. So I had to come to terms with that a bit. So anyway, in the end, I ended up on the one show doing this thing called the Street Barber, where I cut people's hair in the street. And then everybody used to say, you're the guy who does hair anywhere. And I used to think, not really, you know, because I had to find a plug socket. You never see that camera. You know, we used to like nip into the car phone warehouse and say, can we borrow a plug socket, do their hair and then put them back on screen.
Have you got a subsidiary business and extension needs?
Yeah, exactly. We were 30 meters of extension cable and pretending we were doing hair in the street. And then the other thing is that because that program on the one show was 4 minutes long, people thought I could do people's hair really quick. Mm. So they'd say, you're the guy, I could do hair anywhere and you can do it really quick. And then I just used to think, I wish I could do people's hair anywhere. Like, no plug socket, no water. Wouldn't it be great if people could do that to their hair? And then the penny dropped, you know. And when they said, who is Michael Douglas? And I was like, Michael Douglas, who is the person who does hair anywhere. That's who he is. And every retailer was like, that is a bloody great idea. Imagine if you could do anything to your hair anywhere in under 10 minutes without a plug socket and without water. And the idea was born, you know. So we found an industrial engineer, an electrical designer, and we made a prototype for a cordless styling tool and some dry styling products. And it was called Your Hair Anywhere. And everybody bought into it. It was great. And, you know, on the surface of it, it sounds just like a capitalistic kind of money-making idea, you know. And of course, there is that in it as well. But I was genuinely looking for a solution for a problem for people that nobody else was offering. You know, that was what I was waiting for to come round, and it did. And whenever I say that to somebody, imagine you can make your hair look really good in 10 minutes now in a bathroom somewhere before you go somewhere. Or you could make, you know, you could top up your style or re-straighten your hair or whatever. I thought, well, yes, it's a great idea. And I watched this documentary, which I would recommend everybody watch, called The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Oh.
And it's a documentary about a movie producer called Bobby Evans, who was a ladies' clothing salesman back in the 50s, who ended up the head of Paramount Pictures in Hollywood. Yeah, I mean, it's just a fucking nuts story. And he made The Godfather, Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I mean, Paramount was the biggest movie studio in Hollywood once he'd finished with it. And it was the worst once he got hold of it. And it's just a brilliant story. But he narrates his own life story. It's called The Kid Stays in the Picture. It's hilarious, really, because who does that? You know, like, somebody might make a documentary about your life one day, but it shouldn't be you. But he does it himself. It's like, this is my life, you know. And the opening bit of his documentary is there are three sides to every story. Your side, my side, and the truth. And none of them are a lie. This is mine.
Oh.
And it's like, oh. And all of a sudden my brain went, phew. And I'm like, oh yeah, of course. Like your truth of last night, even if we were in the same room, would not be the same as my truth.
Yeah.
And then of course, there's the actual truth of what really happened. You know, like, oh my God, you know, like, anyway, there's a bit in it where they're going to shut Paramount Pictures, the head of Paramount Pictures, this company called Gulf and Western decides, they're going to get rid of Paramount. It's too much money and too much hassle. And they won't let him in the boardroom to pitch to save Paramount Pictures. So he makes a video that he begs the board, the chairman, to show in the boardroom to save Paramount Pictures. And they show the video and they save Paramount Pictures. And I was like, I'm going to make a video and send it to all the investors that I could possibly send it to. Instead of a PDF, which is what everybody sends, like a pitch deck, I thought, one thing I'm good at is communicating with people and talking. I've been talking down the lens of a camera for 20 years. I'm going to make a video where I pitch the idea of my life and why they would be crazy not to invest, you know. And it got shown to one person and he put in 1.2 million quid within 4 weeks. And I was like, wow, that is the power of a good video.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was brilliant. But everyone says, how did you do that? And it's like, watch The Kid Stays in the Picture. That film, I stole so much from that film and I applied it to my life and bang. So yeah, it's quite weird. And it's quite weird when someone says, I'm going to give you, you know, it was 1.325 we raised in the end. And he said, I'm going to give you this money and I'd like you to times 10, times 20 it in the next 5 to 10 years. And you go, yeah, all right, let's do that. It was terrifying.
Well, I was going to say, and also, like, it hasn't necessarily been plainest sailing.
No. So Your Hair Anywhere doesn't exist. We couldn't launch.
That was kind of, I was like, what have I missed?
Where is it? So the price of aluminium went up by 480%. The price of batteries went up by about 1,000%. Manufacturing in China shut down because of COVID. Everything fell apart the moment the money came in the bank. We realised that we couldn't do what we promised we would do. And it's too late at that point. It's quite weird, but you just think, I have to go back to my investors and say, remember all that thing I promised you in that great video that I made? Here's a video where I'm now going to tell you that we can't do that anymore and I'm going to have to think of something else, you know. And it's very weird, but this is around the time that I'd realised that you have to walk straight into the eye of the storm in order to find the answer. So I thought, we walk straight into the eye of the storm, you know. And what's very interesting is what you realize is that most businesses that raise money end up making all their money as a completely different business than the one they thought. And everybody knows this. And the investor...
No one tells you.
Yeah, nobody tells you this. The investor basically said, it's all right. I invested in you, not the idea. Go fill your boots. Tell us what you want to do. And I was like, really? It was as easy as that. Like, oh, I was about to kill myself. So it was very interesting. So what I'd learned through now speaking to thousands and thousands of people on Instagram was like a massive focus group to say, what do you want? You know, I'm in a position to kind of give you something because I've got money, I've got a team, and I've got the ability. What do you want? You know, and everybody wanted a hairdryer as good as Dyson, but not as expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, you know, it was just thousands of people saying, I want something as good as that, but half the price. I was like, great, let's get to work, see what we can do. Because also what I wanted was that, because I don't like the Dyson Supersonic particularly. I know it's a good hairdryer and loads of people love it, so I'm not slagging it off. It just wasn't for me. I hated mm-hmm. the shape of it. Mm-hmm. Didn't like the balance of it either. I like a snout on a hairdryer because I always rest hair over the snout mm-hmm. as you blow dry hair. You know, I didn't think it was massively consumer friendly, and it was ludicrously expensive for a multi-billion dollar company to slightly stiff the hairdressing industry. I mean, I feel like they've exploited the hair industry in the most ridiculous way. For hairdressers to lap up this idea that there's a £330 hairdryer that mm-hmm. blows hot air that somehow everybody should be buying. I just feel like Dyson's nothing to do with the hairdressing industry. He's the vacuum cleaner guy, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. Why are you lining his pockets with billions of pounds when there's loads of people supporting this industry? There's loads of creative hairdressers that could bring out brands that would feed back into the industry. It's like, it just seems criminal, this guy's coming along and making so much bloody money. Anyway, that's a slightly different story, but I thought, okay, let's do that. So we launched the MD London Blow, and I thought Blow was quite a fun name for it, you know, because it's got kind of slightly cheeky connotations, and I quite like Elon Musk, and I like a lot of the things he says, and he always says he loves descriptive branding. So you call your brand what it is, you know. You don't call it something else. You love it. And I thought, oh, this thing blows. Let's call it Blow, you know. So I love that. Obviously, calling something Michael Douglas is confusing. So I'd always have this name of MD London. Should be called MD the North or something like that, really, because I'm from the North. But yeah, you know, and it was just once I found this hairdryer and we designed it, reskinned it, made it the way I wanted it to make it, and then I used it. I was like, fuck, this is the best hairdryer I've ever used. Like, I even love this fucking thing, you know. So I was completely in, you know, I was all in. So, you know, we launched that about, it's only been a year, the 19th of October last year we launched it. And it's been...
birthday's coming up.
Yeah. It's been the most enjoyable, terrifying, funny, you know, weird ride of my life. And taking a million odd pounds off people, because what an investor does, which is very interesting, is they give you most of the money, but not all of it. And you have to raise all of the money.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll say, you know, you need 1.4 million, let's say. And he said, I'll give you a million of it. You need to go and find the other 400 grand.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, there's no deal.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to go out there. And he says, friends and family, you know, I say he, there's plenty of female investors out there. He says, you have to go out there and find the other money from friends and family. Because once you've got friends and family in your business, you know, there's a lot at stake, right?
It's
their money you've taken, you know. So they do that thing very interestingly. I never really thought about that. But they sell it to you as like, look, you're going to make millions and millions of pounds. So why don't you offer it to your friends and family? Because they will thank you for it. And you think, oh yeah, great, let's do that, you know. And then you realize, oh my God, I've got to make this money back for my friend who's put 100 grand of his life savings into something.
All the emotional stakeholders now.
Yeah, like, fuck, I never really thought about that. Yeah, it's hilarious, you know. So that's where we are. And I had to just not think about the money too much. You know, I've never had £1 million in my bank account. And then one day I did, and it's not yours, it's the business's, and you have to multiply it, you know.
And it's like, did you screenshot it? But did you screenshot
your... Yes, I did. Yes. We had the app and I'm like, ka-chink. We had 1.37 million or something in the bank. I thought, I'm going to send that to my brother, you know. so, yeah. But it's, there's plenty. What I realized is that I know lots of people who've tried to raise money for businesses and have bailed. And I think, you were offered the money. Why did you bail? You know, and what I realized when they offer you the money and you walk out the room, you kind of think, I'm out of my depth. I shouldn't do this. Yeah. But I thought, you know what? Fuck that. Like, this is the greatest opportunity of my life. And I'm right to be scared, you know, embrace the fear, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I stopped thinking about it as money, just started thinking about it as a measurement of opportunity, you know.
Well, it's like in that second, isn't it? It goes from being something intangible and like an idea, oh my God, this could happen, to all of a sudden in that second, once you've got the money, I'm guessing that it goes from being that to being something completely different that takes on a completely different size, shape, weight, form, texture, the lot. Like, you're just something that has been something you were so excited about turns to terror, I'm guessing.
Yeah. It's interesting. When we were under production company and we used to go to the BBC to try and get programs made, you know, we'd have an idea and we'd pitch the idea and the idea would go in. And at that moment, you're at your happiest because this thing might get commissioned and it's a great idea. And me and my mate Andy, who makes all my content here with me, we work together now and we have such a great time making that content. It's brilliant because not only do we produce it, but we broadcast it. And then we watch the viewing figures come in and then you see the sales as a result of the viewing figures, you know. So the whole thing's all ours and in our control and we can broadcast what we like. So something great about that. But we used to kind of laugh. We'd put the pitch in, we'd go for a drink and we'd say, like, this is the best bit because it's all possibility at this bit. And often the worst thing that can happen is that they were to say yes, because then you'd have to fucking make it, you know. Like, so this window of where it's just possibilities is so great. And I just think, wouldn't it be great if this goes on for 3 or 4 days? We don't hear anything for 3 or 4 days. We're just in the possibilities realm, you know.
Yeah.
And the worst thing is when they say, yeah, let's do this. And you think, oh my God, we've now got to make something and do all the things we promised on the page, you know. So yeah, there's something in, once you're given the opportunity, the fear of it is, wow, massive.
Based on, we've hurtled through our time together, but I'm just going to ask you, based on everything that you know now, what is the advice that you, what is the lesson that you've learned the most that sort of has cropped up? And it's, you know, there are lessons that you have to learn more than once.
Yes.
It has to keep happening so that you finally learn the lesson. What's been yours?
Yes. Yes. Do you know what? I think patience is probably the biggest one I've got, is that I am 50 now and I have never been happier. I've never felt more on the precipice, you know, like I've got to step off almost every day, you know, but the excitement in stepping off is amazing. And, you know, a lot of me feels a bit sad that this didn't happen when I was 30 or something like that.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad it happened now, and it required, what's it required? You know, 35 years of work to get here. But that's the reason I'm happy, really, is that I don't think I would have been happy at 30. I would have been impatient and angry and snappy and all sorts of stuff. The reason it's good now is because I am here now, you know. Yeah. So I do believe, really, that if you can, you know, tell the truth as much as possible, listen to your conscience, and manifest some stuff, everything happens when it's supposed to happen. And I'm delighted to be 50 and I'm delighted to be in this space, you know. And it most of it's come as a result of, like, surrendering to reality, you know, to life, you know, and allowing it to play out, you know. So, yeah, I think patience, like, and trying to listen to your conscience properly. Because there's this idea that hard work pays off. I look at my mum. She worked hard her whole life and was so unrewarded for it because she was working so hard at the wrong thing, you know. Mm. And I can see that now. Maybe she can, you know. And it's not obvious where you should be working hard, but it's not necessarily at work. It's actually you, you know. It's you that should be working hard on relationships and your life and your interests and pushing yourself all the time. You know, there's that whole thing like, and that idea of, you know, that going back to that Baz Luhrmann song, doing something every day that scares you, you know, just slightly being on the edge of fear a lot is a brilliant place to be. I can't remember, but David Bowie was talking about that recently in something that popped up on Instagram, which was, you know, absolutely you should be slightly confused about what you're doing. Like an imposter syndrome, like, is the place. You should feel like an imposter.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing. You know, when people say I suffer with imposter syndrome, I was thinking, well, you're in the right place. You know, that's exactly what you should feel like. I don't really know what I'm doing. Oh, great. You'll soon work it out. Yeah. And then feel it again, and then feel it again, and feel it again, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's a lot of long, convoluted answer, because it's probably a mixture of all those things. But patience and fear, you know, it's a great place to be at least once or twice a day.
Yeah, it's a mixture of things. And it's also, I guess, as well, the thing I was taking from that was trusting the process.
Yeah, got to have faith, you know. That's the thing about surrendering, I think, also, is that you surrender to what's going to happen, which means letting go of control, you know.
Yeah.
One of the things that I did find about this business is that I've got two director partners that are shareholders, and they're in it with me. And they're not directed by me at all. They are in this business and they're making it work, and just let them do their thing. I'm not controlling at all, and they'll make mistakes and fuck things up, and so will I, and then, you know, we'll learn something from that and not do it again. But
yeah,
it's a joy letting go of them as well, you know. Sorry, I'm slightly
drifted
off there, but I'm just, you know, there's ideas coming all the time about this whole idea of letting go of control.
Taken so much from this conversation. First of all, I'll be watching Stuts and
Keep the Kid in the Picture.
Kid Stays in the Picture. I would definitely put that. But honestly, this has been really wonderful. Thank you so much. So much wisdom.
Pleasure. And your podcast is great, and it's a great honor to be on. So thanks so much. And having the opportunity to explore your mind like this as well is very helpful. I mean, this is therapy in a way, isn't it? So people are asking you questions about yourself, you know. Oh, yeah, I never really thought about that, but now I will think about it, you know. So thank you very much indeed for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Well, listen, I'm obviously going to put the links to you and to the MD London Blow in the show notes. And for anyone who hasn't already seen on Instagram, Michael very kindly gave me one. My God, I've got the camo green. And okay. It's now my dryer of choice.
Oh, great, great.
Genuinely, I'm just obsessed with it.
We've got some accessories that are going to come out that can attach to the end of the hairdryer and do really, really nice things. I tested one yesterday we've just got, and I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. So there's other things going to come with the dryer to kind of broaden its abilities, you know. It's good. But thank you.
I'm excited. And I know it's just launched in Blush, so I'm sure I'm sure it's flying off the shelves at the moment.
It's very well, yeah. I mean, it's very interesting that just before we go, like, when we launched this business, it didn't do very well initially, despite having Davina behind it and all sorts of things. But it was very much a trust the process thing. I just kept thinking, okay, let's just see what happens. And it took a month or two for things to gather speed, and then Black Friday and Christmas and all sorts of things. So, you know, it was just if anybody out there, I know there's lots of people in the beauty world that listen to this podcast that have launched businesses recently that might find, Jesus, it's not gone like I thought it would. It never does. Like, whew, sit tight.
Do you know what I've learned as well? There's a perception lag, or there's a reality lag.
Yeah.
So some people will engage with you via your Instagram feed. So if you've just posted a sort of a retrospective, when I went to, I don't know, the Serpentine Gallery or something, the next time they speak to you, they'll talk to you about something that you did 2 years ago. Or if somebody listened to your podcast 3 years ago, that's where they left you. So there's these time lags, you're living your experience. So you think everyone's going to be where you are. Everyone is up to a decade behind you.
Yeah.
Or when they last left you, which I think is quite useful to remember sometimes.
Yeah, it's very good. Bloody hell.
I know. Well, I'm sure we shall continue this in person and have more deep and meaningful. I would like that very much.
Me too. Anytime you want your hair done or anything like that, just give us a shout. We're always here.
You've done it now. Emma loves a trim.
Yeah, honestly, anytime.
Oh, pleasure. Well, thank you so much. The links to you, MD London Blow, and everything else will be in the show notes. But Michael Douglas, what an absolute joy. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to that episode of The Emma Gunn Show. I do hope you enjoyed it. I appreciate your time hugely. If you did enjoy it and you never want to miss an episode, then please do hit the subscribe button wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. It's also where you get the opportunity to leave a 5-star review and a rating for how you feel about the show. And I'd be so grateful if you wouldn't mind leaving one. If you want to get in touch with me, email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Or you can DM me on Instagram and Twitter, where I am at Emma Gunns. If you fancy chatting to me and thousands of other fellow listeners of the podcast, then click the link to join the Facebook forum. The link to join is in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. You have to answer a couple of questions, but we cannot wait to see you there. Come over and join the conversation. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you on the next one.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.